large wooden tub at Tadatoshi's feet. Letting the upper part of his kimono hang loose, he wiped off his chest and washed his feet. His men assisted by holding his sleeves, running to fetch more water and wiping off his back. There was nothing formal in their manner, nothing to suggest to an observer that this was a daimyo and his retinue. Kojiro had supposed that Tadatoshi, a poet and an aesthete, the son of Lord Sansai and the grandson of Lord Yosai, would be a man of aristocratic bearing, as refined in his conduct as the elegant courtiers of Kyoto. But his surprise did not show in his eyes as he watched. Slipping his still damp feet into his zori, Tadatoshi looked at Kakube, who was waiting off to one side. With the air of one who has suddenly recalled a promise, he said, "Now, Kakube, I'll see your man." He had a stool brought and placed in the shade of a tent, where he sat down in front of a banner bearing his crest, a circle surrounded by 8 smaller circles, representing the sun, moon, and 7 planets. Beckoned by Kakube, Kojiro came forward and knelt before Lord Tadatoshi. As soon as the formal greeting was completed, Tadatoshi invited Kojiro to sit on a stool, thus signifying that he was an honored guest. "By your leave," said Kojiro, as he rose and took a seat facing Tadatoshi. "I've heard about you from Kakube. I believe you were born in Iwakuni, weren't you?"
"That is correct, sir."
"Lord Kikawa Hiroie of Iwakuni was well known as a wise and noble ruler. Were your ancestors retainers of his?"
"No, we never served the house of Kikawa. I've been told we've descended from the Sasakis of Omi Province. After the fall of the last Ashikaga Shogun, my father seems to have retired to my mother's village."
After a few more questions concerning family and lineage, Lord Tadatoshi asked, "Will you be going into service for the first time?"
"I do not yet know whether I am going into service."
"I gathered from Kakube you wish to serve the House of Hosokawa. What are your reasons?"
"I believe it is a house I would be willing to live and die for."
Tadatoshi seemed pleased with this answer.
"And your style of fighting?" "I call it the Gandyu style."
"Gandyu?"
"It's a style I invented myself."
"Presumably it has antecedents."
"I studied the Tomita style, and I had the benefit of lessons from Lord Katayama Hisayasu of Hoki, who in his old age retired to Iwakuni. I've also mastered many techniques of my own. I used to practice cutting down swallows on the wing."
"I see. I suppose the name Gandyu comes from the name of that river near where you were born?"
"Yes, sir."
"I'd like to see a demonstration." Tadatoshi looked around at the faces of his samurai. "Which one of you would like to take this man on?" They had been watching the interview in silence, thinking that Kojiro was remarkably young to have acquired the reputation he had. Now all looked first at each other, then at Kojiro, whose flushed cheeks proclaimed his willingness to face any challenger.
"How about you, Okatani?"
"Yes, sir."
"You're always claiming the lance is superior to the sword. Now's your chance to prove it."
"I shall be glad to, if Sasaki is willing."
"By all means,"
Kojiro answered with alacrity. In his tone, which was polite but extremely cool, there was a hint of cruelty. The samurai, who had been sweeping the sand on the archery range and putting away the equipment, assembled behind their master. Although weapons were as familiar to them as chopsticks, their experience had been primarily in the dojo. The chance to witness, much less have, a real bout would occur only a few times throughout their lives. They would readily agree that a man-to-man fight was a greater challenge than going out on the battlefield, where it was sometimes possible for a man to pause and get his wind while his comrades fought on. In hand-to-hand combat, he had only himself to rely on, only his own alertness and strength from beginning to end. Either he won, or he was killed or maimed. They watched Okatani Goroji solemnly. Even among the lowest-ranking foot soldiers, there were quite a few who were adept with the lance. Goroji was generally conceded to be the best. He had not only been in battle, but had practiced diligently and devised techniques of his own.
"Give me a few minutes," said Goroji, bowing toward Tadatoshi and Kojiro before withdrawing to make his preparations.
It pleased him that today, as on other days, he had on spotless underwear, in the tradition of the good samurai, who started each day with a smile and an uncertainty. By evening, he might be a corpse. After borrowing a 3-foot wooden sword, Kojiro selected the ground for the match. His body seemed relaxed and open, the more so since he didn't hitch up his pleated hakama. His appearance was formidable. Even his enemies would have had to admit that. There was an eagle-like air of valor about him, and his handsome profile was serenely confident. Worried eyes began to turn toward the canopy behind which Goroji was adjusting his clothing and equipment.
"What's taking him so long?" someone asked.
Goroji was calmly wrapping a piece of damp cloth around the point of his lance, a weapon he had used to excellent effect on the battlefield. The shaft was 9 feet long, and the tapering blade alone, at 8 or 9 inches, was the equivalent of a short sword.
"What are you doing?" called Kojiro. "If you're worried about hurting me, save yourself the trouble."
Again, though the words were courteous, the implication was arrogant.
"I don't mind if you leave it unwrapped."
Looking sharply at him, Goroji said,
"Are you sure?"
"Perfectly."
Though neither Lord Tadatoshi nor his men spoke, their perceiving eyes told Goroji to go ahead. If the stranger had the gall to ask for it, why not run him through?
"In that case,"
Goroji tore off the wrapping and advanced, holding the lance midway along the shaft.
"I'm happy to comply, but if I use a naked blade, I want you to use a real sword."
"This wooden one's fine."
"No, I can't agree to that."
"Certainly you wouldn't expect me, an outsider, to have the audacity to employ a real sword in the presence of his lordship."
"But—"
With a touch of impatience, Lord Tadatoshi said,
"Go ahead, Okatani. Nobody will consider you cowardly for complying with the man's request."
It was obvious Kojiro's attitude had affected him. The two men, faces flushed with determination, exchanged greetings with their eyes. Goroji made the first move, leaping to the side, but Kojiro, like a bird stuck to a limed fowling pole, slipped under the lance and struck directly at his chest. Lacking time to thrust, the lancer whirled sideways and tried to jab the nape of Kojiro's neck with the butt of his weapon. With a resounding crack, the lance flew back up into the air as Kojiro's sword bit into Goroji's ribs, which had been exposed by the momentum of the rising lance. Goroji slid to one side, then leapt away, but the attack continued without let-up. With no time to catch his breath, he jumped aside again, then again, and again. The first few dodges were successful, but he was like a peregrine falcon trying to fend off an eagle. Hounded by the raging sword, the lance shaft snapped in two. At the same instant, Goroji emitted a cry. It sounded as though his soul was being torn from his body. The brief battle was ended. Kojiro had hoped to take on 4 or 5 men, but Tadatoshi said that he had seen enough. When Kakube came home that evening, Kojiro asked him,
"Did I go a little too far? In front of his lordship, I mean?"
"No, it was a magnificent performance."
Kakube felt rather ill at ease. Now that he could assess the full extent of Kojiro's ability, he felt like a man who had hugged a tiny bird to his chest, only to see it grow up to be an eagle.
"Did Lord Tadatoshi say anything?"
"Nothing in particular."
"Come now, he must have said something."
"Nope. He left the archery range without a word."
Kojiro looked disappointed, but said,
"Oh, it doesn't matter. He impressed me as a greater man than he's usually made out to be. I was thinking if I had to serve anyone, it might as well be him. But of course, I have no control over how things turn out."
He didn't reveal how carefully he had thought about the situation. After the Date, Kuroda, Shimazu, and Mori clans, the Hosokawa was the most prestigious and secure. He felt sure this would continue to be true so long as Lord Sansai held the Buzen fief. And sooner or later, Edo and Osaka would clash once and for all. There was no way of predicting the outcome. A samurai who had chosen the wrong master might easily find himself a ronin again, his whole life sacrificed for a few months' stipend. The day after the bout, word came that Goroji had survived, though his pelvis or left thigh bone had been smashed. Kojiro accepted the news calmly, telling himself that even if he did not receive a position, he had given a good enough account of himself. A few days later, he abruptly announced he was going to pay a call on Goroji. Offering no explanation for this sudden display of kindness, he set out alone and on foot for Goroji's house near Tokiwa Bridge. The unexpected visitor was received cordially by the injured man. "A match is a match," said Goroji, a smile on his lips and moistness in his eyes. "I may deplore my own lack of skill, but I certainly hold nothing against you. It was good of you to come to see me. Thank you." After Kojiro left, Goroji remarked to a friend, "Now there's a samurai I can admire. I thought he was an arrogant son of a bitch, but he turns out to be both friendly and polite." This was precisely the reaction Kojiro had hoped for. It was part of his plan. Other visitors would hear him praised by the defeated man himself. Calling once every 2 or 3 days, he made 3 more visits to Goroji's house. On one occasion, he had a live fish delivered from the fish market as a get-well present. Green Persimmons. In the dog days after the summer rainy season, the land crabs crawled sluggishly in the parched street, and the signs taunting Musashi to come out and fight were no longer visible. The few that hadn't fallen in the rain-softened earth or been stolen for firewood were obscured by weeds and tall grass. "There must be something somewhere," thought Kojiro, looking around for a place to eat. But this was Edo, not Kyoto, and the cheap rice and tea shops so common in the older city had not yet made their appearance here. The only likely place stood in a vacant lot, screened off with reed blinds. Smoke rose lazily from behind the blinds, and on a vertical banner was the word Donjiki. The word immediately reminded him of Tonjiki, which in the distant past had meant the rice balls used as military rations. As he approached, he heard a masculine voice ask for a cup of tea. Inside, 2 samurai were energetically gobbling rice, one from an ordinary rice bowl, the other from a sake bowl. Kojiro seated himself on the edge of a bench across from them and asked the proprietor, "What do you have?"
"Rice dishes. I also have sake."
"On the banner it says Donjiki. What does that mean?"
"As a matter of fact, I don't know."
"Didn't you write it?"
"No.
It was written by a retired merchant who stopped in to rest."
"I see. Good calligraphy, I must say." "He said he was on a religious pilgrimage. Said he'd visited Hirakawa Tenjin Shrine, Hikawa Shrine, Kanda Myojin, all sorts of places, making big contributions to each of them. Very pious and generous, he seemed."
"Do you know his name?"
"He told me it was Daizo of Narai."
"I've heard the name."
"Donjiki. Well, I don't understand it. But I figured if a fine man like him wrote it, it might help keep the god of poverty away." He laughed.
After a look into several large china bowls, Kojiro took some rice and fish, poured tea over the rice, brushed a fly away with his chopsticks, and began eating. One of the other customers stood up and peered through a broken slat in the blind.
"Take a look out there, Hamada," he said to his companion. "Isn't that the watermelon vendor?"
The other man went quickly to the blind and looked out.
Yeah, that's him, all right.
The vendor, shouldering a pole with baskets at either end, was walking languidly past the donjiki. The two samurai ran out of the shop and caught up with him. Drawing their swords, they cut the ropes supporting the baskets. The vendor stumbled forward, along with the melons. Hamada yanked him up by the scruff of his neck. "Where did you take her?" he demanded angrily. "Don't lie! You must be hiding her somewhere!" The other samurai thrust the tip of his sword under the captive's nose.
"Out with it! Where is she?"
The sword blade tapped menacingly against the man's cheek.
"How could anyone with a face like yours think of going off with somebody else's woman?"
The vendor, cheeks flushed with anger and fear, shook his head, but then, seeing an opening, shoved one of his captors out of the way, picked up his pole, and took a swing at the other one.
"So you want to fight, do you? Careful, Hamada. This guy's not just an ordinary melon vendor." "What can this ass do?"
sneered Hamada, snatching the pole and knocking the vendor to the ground. Straddling him, he used the ropes to tie him to the pole. A cry like that of a stuck pig went up behind him. Hamada turned his face around, right into a spray of fine red mist. Looking totally dumbfounded, he jumped up, screaming,
"Who are you? What?"
The adder-like blade moved directly toward him. Kojiro laughed, and as Hamada shrank back, followed him relentlessly. The two moved in a circle through the grass. When Hamada moved back a foot, Kojiro moved forward the same distance. When Hamada leapt to one side, the drying pole followed, pointing unwaveringly at its prospective victim. The melon vendor cried out in astonishment,
"Kojiro! It's me! Save me!"
Hamada blanched with terror and gasped,
"Kojiro!"
Then he wheeled around and tried to flee.
"Where do you think you're going?" barked Kojiro.
The drawing pole flashed through the sultry stillness, lopping off Hamada's ear and lodging deep in the flesh under the shoulders. He died on the spot. Kojiro promptly cut the melon vendor's bonds. Rearranging himself into a proper sitting posture, the man bowed and stayed bowed, too embarrassed to show his face. Kojiro wiped and resheathed his sword. Amusement playing faintly around his lips, he said,
"What's the matter with you, Matahachi? Don't look so miserable. You're still alive."
"Yes, sir."
"None of this yes, sir business. Look at me. It's been a long time, hasn't it?"
"I'm glad you're well."
"Why wouldn't I be? But I must say, you've taken to an unusual trade."
"Let's not talk about it."
"All right. Pick up your melons. Then, I know, why don't you leave them at the donjiki?"
With a loud shout, he summoned the proprietor, who helped them stack the melons behind the blinds. Kojiro took out his brush and ink and wrote on one of the shoji, "To whom it may concern, I certify that the person who killed the two men lying on this vacant lot was myself, Sasaki Kojiro, a ronin residing at Tsukinomisaki." To the proprietor, he said, "This should fix it so no one will bother you about the killings."
"Thank you, sir."
"Think nothing of it. If friends or relatives of the dead men should come around, please deliver this message for me. Tell them I won't run away. If they want to see me, I'm ready to greet them any time."
Outside again, he said to Matahachi, "Let's go." Matahachi walked beside him, but would not take his eyes off the ground. Not once since coming to Edo had he held a steady job. Whatever his intention, to become a shugyosha or to go into business, when he found the going rough, he changed jobs. And after Otsu slipped away from him, he felt less and less like working. He'd slept in first one place, then another, sometimes at flop houses populated by hoodlums. The past few weeks, he had been making his living as a common peddler, trudging from one part of the castle wall to another, hawking watermelons. Kojiro wasn't particularly interested in what Matachi had been doing, but he had written a sign at the donjiki, and he might later be questioned about the incident. "Why did those samurai have it in for you?" he asked.
"To tell the truth, it had to do with a woman."
Kojiro smiled, thinking wherever Matahachi went, there soon arose some difficulty connected with women. Perhaps this was his karma.
"Hmm,"
he mumbled. "The great lover in action again, hey?" Then more loudly, "Who is the woman, and what exactly happened?" It took some prodding, but eventually Matahachi gave in and told his tale, or part of it. Near the moat, there were dozens of tiny tea shops catering to construction workers and passers-by. In one of these, there had been a waitress who caught everybody's eyes, enticing men who did not want tea to step in for a cup, and men who were not hungry to order bowls of sweet jelly. One regular customer had been Hamada. Matahachi, too, dropped in occasionally. One day, this waitress whispered to him that she needed his help. "That Ronin," she had said, "I don't like him, but every night after the shop closes, the master orders me to go home with him. Won't you let me come and hide in your house? I won't be a burden. I'll cook for you and mend your clothes." Since her plea seemed reasonable, Matahachi had agreed. That was all there was to it, he insisted. Kojiro was unconvinced.
"It sounds fishy to me."
"Why?" Matahachi asked. Kojiro could not decide whether Matahachi was trying to make himself appear innocent or whether he was bragging about an amorous conquest. Without even smiling, he said, "Never mind. It's hot out here under the sun. Let's go to your house, and you can tell me about it in more detail." Matahachi stopped in his tracks. "Is there anything wrong with that?" asked Kojiro.
"Well, my place is... it's not the sort of place I'd want to take you to."
Seeing the distressed look in Matahachi's eyes, Kojiro said lightly,
"Never mind. But one of these days, soon, you must come to see me. I'm staying with Iwama Kakube, about halfway up Isarago Hill."
"I'd like that.
By the way, did you see the signs posted around the city recently, the ones addressed to Musashi?"
"Yes."
"They said your mother was looking for him, too. Why don't you go to see her?"
"Not the way I am now."
"Idiot. You don't have to put on a great show for your own mother. There's no way of knowing just when she might find Musashi, and if you're not there at the time, you'll lose the chance of a lifetime. You'd regret that, wouldn't you?"
"Yes. I'll have to do something about that soon," Matahachi said non-committally, thinking resentfully that other people, including the man who had just saved his life, did not understand the feelings between mothers and their offspring. They parted, Matahachi ambling down a grassy lane, Kojiro ostensibly setting out in the opposite direction. Kojiro soon doubled back and followed Matahachi, taking care to stay out of sight. Matahachi arrived presently at a motley collection of longhouses, one-story tenements, each containing three or four small apartments under a single roof. Since Edo had grown rapidly and not everybody could be choosy about where he lived, people cleared land as the necessity arose. Streets came into existence afterward, developing naturally from pathways. Drainage, too, came about by accident, as wastewater cut its own path to the nearest stream. Had it not been for these jerry-built slums, the influx of newcomers could have not been absorbed. The majority of the inhabitants of such places were, of course, workmen. Near his home, Matahachi was greeted by a neighbor named Umpe, the boss of a crew of well-diggers. Umpe was seated cross-legged in a large wooden tub, only his face showing above the rain shutter placed sideways in front of the tub for privacy. "Good evening," said Matahachi. "I see you're having your bath."
"I'm about to get out," replied the boss genially. "Would you like to use it next?"
"Thanks, but I think Akemi's probably heated water for me."
"You two are very fond of each other, aren't you? Nobody around here seems to know whether you're brother and sister or husband and wife. Which is it?"
Matahachi giggled sheepishly. The appearance of Akemi saved him from having to answer. She placed a tub under a persimmon tree and brought pailfuls of hot water from the house to fill it. When she was done, she said,
"Feel it, Matahachi. See if it's hot enough."
It's a little too hot.
There was the squeaking of the well pulley, and Matahachi, stripped to his loincloth, brought up a bucket of cold water and poured it into the bath before climbing in himself.
Ah, he sighed contentedly. This feels good.
Umpei, wearing a cotton summer kimono, placed a bamboo stool under a gourd trellis and sat down.
Did you sell lots of melons?
He inquired.
Not many. I never sell very many.
Noticing dried blood between his fingers, he hastily wiped it off.
I don't imagine you would. I still think your life would be easier if you went to work on a well-digging gang.
You're always saying that. Don't think I'm ungrateful, but if I did that, they wouldn't let me off the castle grounds, would they? That's why Akemi doesn't want me to take the job. She says she'd be lonesome without me.
Happily married couple, eh? Well, well.
Ouch!
What's the matter?
Something fell on my head.
A green persimmon landed on the ground just behind Matahachi.
Aha! Punishment for bragging about your wife's devotion, that's what it is.
Still laughing, Umpei wrapped his tannin-coated fan on his knee. Over 60 years old, with a shaggy, hemp-like mane of white hair, Umpei was a man who enjoyed the respect of his neighbors and the admiration of the young people, whom he big-heartedly treated as his own children. Each morning he could be heard chanting, Namu Myoho Renge Kyo, the sacred invocation of the Nichiren sect. A native of Ito in Izu province, he had a sign in front of his house saying, Ido Hori no Umpei, well digger for the shogun's castle. To build the many wells necessary for the castle involved technical skills beyond those of ordinary laborers. Umpei had been hired as a consultant and recruiter of workers because of his long experience in the gold mines of Izu Peninsula. He enjoyed nothing more than sitting under his beloved gourd trellis, spinning yarns and drinking his nightly cup of cheap but potent shochu, the poor man's sake. After Matahachi emerged from the bath, Akemi surrounded the washtub with rain shutters and had hers. Later, the matter of Umpei's proposal came up once again. Besides having to stay on the castle grounds, the workers were watched very closely, and their families were virtually hostages of the bosses of the areas where they lived. On the other hand, the work was easier than on the outside and paid at least twice as much. Leaning over a tray on which there was a dish of cold bean curd, garnished with fresh, fragrant basil leaf, Matachi said,
I don't want to become a prisoner just to earn a little money. I'm not going to sell melons all my life, but bear with me a little longer, Akemi.
She replied between mouthfuls of tea and rice gruel.
I'd rather you try just once to do something really worthwhile, something that would make people take notice.
Though nothing was ever said or done to discourage the idea that she was Matahachi's legal wife, she wasn't about to marry anyone who shilly-shallied the way he did. Fleeing the world of play at Sakaimachi with Matahachi had been only an expedient. He was the perch from which she intended, at the first opportunity, to fly once more into the open sky. But it did not suit her purposes for Matahachi to go off to the castle to work. She felt being left alone would be dangerous. Specifically, she was afraid Hamada might find her and force her to live with him.
Oh, I forgot, said Matahachi, as they finished their frugal meal.
He then told her about his experiences that day, adjusting the details in a fashion calculated to please her. By the time he had finished, her face was ashen. Taking a deep breath, she said,
You saw Kojiro? Did you tell him I was here? You didn't, did you?
Matachi took her hand and placed it on his knee.
Of course not. Do you think I'd let that bastard know where you are? He's the kind that never gives up. He'd be after you.
He broke off with an inarticulate shout and pressed his hand to the side of his face. The green persimmon that smashed against his cheek broke and spattered its whitish meat in Akemi's face. Outside, in the shadows of a moonlit bamboo grove, A form not unlike that of Kojiro could be seen walking nonchalantly away in the direction of town. Eyes.
Sensei!
Called Iori, who was not yet tall enough to see over the tall grass. They were on Musashino Plain, which was said to cover 10 counties.
I'm right here, replied Musashi. What's taking you so long?
I guess there's a path, but I keep losing it. How much farther do we have to go?
Till we find a good place to live.
Live? We're going to stay around here?
Why shouldn't we?
Iori gazed up at the sky, thought of its vastness and the emptiness of the land around him, and said, I wonder.
Think what it'll be like in the fall. Clear, beautiful skies, fresh dew on the grass. Doesn't it make you feel cleaner just thinking about it?
Well, maybe, but I'm not against living in the city like you.
I'm not really. In a way, it's nice to be among people, but even with my thick skin, I couldn't stand being there when those signs were put up. You saw what they said.
Iori grimaced.
I get mad just thinking about it.
Why let yourself get angry over that?
I couldn't help it. No matter where I went, there wasn't anybody who'd say anything good about you.
Nothing I could do about that.
You could have cut down the men spreading the rumors. You could have put up your own signs, challenging them.
There's no point in starting fights you can't win.
You wouldn't have lost to that scum. You couldn't have.
No, you're wrong. I would have.
How?
Sheer numbers. If I beat 10, there'd be 100 more. If I defeated 100, there'd be 1,000. There's no possibility of winning in that kind of situation.
But does that mean you're going to be laughed at for the rest of your life?
Of course not. I'm as determined as the next person to have a good name. I owe it to my ancestors. And I intend to become a man who's never laughed at. That's what I came out here to learn.
We can walk all we want, but I don't think we're going to find any houses. Shouldn't we try to find a temple to stay in again?
That's not a bad idea. But what I really want is to find some place with a lot of trees and build a house of our own.
It'll be like Hotengahara again, won't it?
No. This time, we're not going to farm. I think maybe I'll practice Zen meditation every day. You can read books, and I'll give you some lessons in the sword.
Entering the plain at the village of Kashiwagi, the Koshu entrance to Edo, they had come down the long slope from Junishogongen and followed a narrow path that repeatedly threatened to disappear among the waving summer grasses. When they finally reached the pine-covered knoll, Musashi made a quick survey of the terrain and said,
"This'll do fine."
To him, any place could serve as home. More than that, wherever he happened to be was the universe. They borrowed tools and hired a laborer at the nearest farmhouse. Musashi's approach to building a house was not at all sophisticated. In fact, he could have learned quite a bit from watching birds build a nest. The result, finished a few days later, was an oddity, less substantial than a hermit's mountain retreat, but not so crude as to be described as a shed. The posts were logs with the bark left on. The remainder, a rough alliance of boards, bark, bamboo, and miscanthus. Standing back to take a good look, Musashi remarked thoughtfully, "This must be like the houses people lived in back in the age of the gods." The only relief from the primitiveness were scraps of paper lovingly fashioned to make small shoji. In the days following, the sound of Iori's voice, floating from behind a reed blind as he recited his lessons, rose above the buzz of the cicadas. His training had become very strict in every respect. With Jotaro, Musashi had not insisted on discipline, thinking at the time that it was best to let growing boys grow naturally. But with the passage of time, he had observed that, if anything, bad traits tended to develop and good ones to be repressed. Similarly, he had noticed that trees and plants he wanted to grow would not grow, while weeds and brush flourished no matter how often he cut them down. During the 100 years after the Onin War, the nation had been like a tangled mass of overgrown hemp plants. Then Nobunaga had cut the plants down, Hideyoshi had bundled them up, and Ieyasu had broken and smoothed the ground to build a new world. As Musashi saw it, warriors who placed a high value only on martial practices and whose most noticeable characteristic was unbounded ambition were no longer the dominant element in society. Sekigahara had put an end to that. He had come to believe that whether the nation remained in the hands of the Tokugawas or reverted to the Toyotomis, people in general already knew the direction they wanted to move in, from chaos toward order, from destruction toward construction. At times, he'd had the feeling he had been born too late. No sooner had Hideyoshi's glory penetrated into remote rural areas and fired the hearts of boys like Musashi than the possibility of following in Hideyoshi's footsteps evaporated. So it was his own experience that led to his decision to emphasize discipline in Iori's upbringing. If he was going to create a samurai, he should create one for the coming era, not for the past.
Iori!
Yes, sir? The boy was kneeling before Musashi almost before the words were out.
It's almost sunset. Time for our practice. Bring the swords.
Yes, sir. When he placed them in front of Musashi, he knelt and formally requested a lesson. Musashi's sword was long, Iori's short, both wooden practice weapons. Teacher and pupil faced each other in tense silence, swords held at eye level. A rim of sunlight hovered on the horizon. The cryptomeria grove behind the cabin was already sunk in gloom, but if one looked toward the voices of the cicadas, a sliver of moon was visible through the branches.
Eyes, said Musashi.
Iori opened his eyes wide.
My eyes! Look at them!
Iori did his best, but his eyes seemed to literally bounce away from Musashi's. Instead of glaring, he was being defeated by his opponent's eyes. When he tried again, he was seized by giddiness. His head began to feel as if it were no longer his own. His hands, his feet, his whole body felt wobbly.
Look at my eyes!
Musashi commanded with great sternness. Iori's look had strayed again. Then, concentrating on his master's eyes, he forgot the sword in his hand. The short length of curved wood seemed to become as heavy as a bar of steel.
Eyes! Eyes! Said Musashi, advancing slightly.
Iori checked the urge to fall back, for which he had been scolded dozens of times. But when he attempted to follow his opponent's lead and move forward, his feet were nailed to the ground. Unable either to advance or to retreat, he could feel his body temperature rise. What's the matter with me? The thought exploded like fireworks inside him. Sensing this burst of mental energy, Musashi yelled, "Charge!" At the same time, he lowered his shoulders, dropped back, and dodged with the agility of a fish. With a gasp, Iori sprang forward, spun around, and saw Musashi standing where he himself had been. Then the confrontation began again, just as before, both teacher and pupil maintaining strict silence. Before long, the grass was soaked with dew, and the eyebrow of a moon hung above the cryptomerias. Each time the wind gusted, the insects stopped singing momentarily. Autumn had come, and the wild flowers, though not spectacular in the daytime, now quivered gracefully, like the feathered robe of a dancing deity.
"Enough!"
said Musashi, lowering his sword. As he handed it to Iori, they became conscious of a voice coming from the direction of the grove.
"I wonder who that is," said Musashi.
"Probably a lost traveler wanting to put up for the night. Run and see." As Iori sped around to the other side of the building, Musashi seated himself on the bamboo veranda and gazed out over the plain. The eulalias were tall, their tops fluffy. The light bathing the grass had a peculiar autumn sheen. When Iori returned, Musashi asked,
"A traveler?"
"No, a guest."
"Guest? Here?"
It's Hojo Shinzo. He tied his horse up and he's waiting for you in back.
This house doesn't really have any back or front, but I think it'd be better to receive him here.
Iori ran around the side of the cabin, shouting, "Please, come this way!"
"This is a pleasure," said Musashi, his eyes expressing his delight at seeing Shinzo completely recovered. "Sorry to have been out of touch so long. I suppose you live out here to get away from people. I hope you'll forgive me for dropping in unexpectedly like this."
Greetings having been exchanged, Musashi invited Shinzo to join him on the veranda.
"How did you find me? I haven't told anyone where I am."
"Tsushino Kosuke. He said you'd finished the kannon you promised him and sent Iori to deliver it."
"Aha! I suppose Iori let the secret out. It doesn't matter. I'm not old enough to abandon the world and retire. I did think, though, that if I left the scene for a couple of months, the malicious gossip would quiet down. Then there'd be less danger of reprisals against Kosuke and my other friends."
Shinzo lowered his head.
"I owe you an apology. All this trouble because of me."
"Not really. That was a minor thing. The real root of the matter has to do with the relationship between Kojiro and me.
Did you know he killed Obata Yogoro?"
"No."
"Yogoro, when he heard about me, decided to take revenge himself. He was no match for Kojiro."
"I warned him." The image of the youthful Yogoro standing in the entrance of his father's house was still vivid in Musashi's mind.
"What a pity," he thought to himself. "I can understand how he felt," continued Shinzo. "The students had all left, and his father had died. He must have thought he was the only one who could do it. In any case, he appears to have gone to Kojiro's house. Still, no one saw them together. There's no real proof."
Maybe my warning had the opposite effect from what I intended. Stirred up his pride so he felt he had to fight.
It's a shame."
"It is.
Yogoro was Sensei's only blood relation. With his death, the house of Obata ceased to exist. However, my father discussed the matter with Lord Munenori, who somehow managed to institute adoption proceedings. I'm to become Kagenori's heir and successor and carry on the Obata name. I'm not sure I'm mature enough yet. I'm afraid I may end up bringing further disgrace to the man. After all, he was the greatest proponent of the Koshu military tradition."
"Your father's the Lord of Awa. Isn't the Hojo military tradition considered to be on a par with the Koshu school? And your father as great a master as Kagenori?"
"That's what they say. Our ancestors came from Totomi province. My grandfather served Hojo Ujitsuna and Hojo Ujiyasu of Odawara, and my father was selected by Ieyasu himself to succeed them as head of the family."
"Coming from a famous military family, isn't it unusual for you to have become a disciple of Kagenori's?"
"My father has his disciples, and he's given lectures before the shogun on military science. But instead of teaching me anything, he told me to go out and learn from somebody else. Find out the hard way. That's the kind of man he is."
Musashi sensed an element of intrinsic decency, even nobility, in Shinzo's demeanor. And it was probably natural, he thought, for his father, Ujikatsu, was an outstanding general, and his mother was the daughter of Hojo Ujiyasu.
"I'm afraid I've been talking too much," said Shinzo. "Actually, my father sent me out here. Of course, it would have been only proper for him to come and express his gratitude to you in person, but just now he has a guest who's quite eager to see you. My father told me to bring you back with me. Will you come?"
He peered inquiringly into Musashi's face.
"A guest of your father's wants to see me?"
"That's right."
"Who could it be? I know almost no one in Edo." "A person you've known since you were a boy."
Musashi couldn't imagine who it might be. Matahachi, perhaps? A samurai from Takeyama Castle? a friend of his father's. Maybe even Otsu.
But Shinzo refused to divulge his secret.
I was instructed not to tell you who it is. The guest said it would be better to surprise you. Will you come?
Musashi's curiosity was piqued. He told himself it couldn't be Otsu, but in his heart hoped it was.
Let's go, he said, rising to his feet. Iori, don't wait up for me.
Shinzo, pleased that his mission was successful, went behind the house and brought his horse. Saddle and stirrups were dripping with dew. Holding the bit, he offered the horse to Musashi, who proceeded without further ado to mount it. As they left, Musashi said to Iori,
"Take care of yourself. I may not be back until tomorrow."
It was not long before he was swallowed up by the evening mist.
Iori sat quietly on the veranda, lost in thought.
Eyes, he thought. Eyes.
Innumerable times he had been ordered to keep his eyes on his opponents, but as yet he could neither understand the import of the instruction nor get the idea out of his mind. He gazed vacantly up at the river of heaven.
What was wrong with him? Why was it that when Musashi stared at him, he couldn't stare straight back?
More vexed by his failure than an adult would have been, he was trying very hard to find the explanation when he became conscious of a pair of eyes. They were aimed at him from the branches of a wild grapevine, which twined around a tree in front of the cabin.
What's that? He thought.
The brightly shining eyes reminded him strongly of Musashi's eyes during practice sessions.
Must be a possum.
He had seen one several times, eating the wild grapes. The eyes were like agate, the eyes of a fierce hobgoblin.
Beast! Cried Iori. You think I don't have any courage? Think even you can outstare me? Well, I'll show you. I'm not about to lose to you.
With grim determination, he tensed his elbows and glared back. The possum, whether out of stubbornness or curiosity, made no move to flee. Its eyes took on an even more lustrous brilliance. The effort so absorbed Iori that he forgot to breathe. He swore again not to lose, not to this lowly beast. After what seemed like hours, he realized with a flash that he had triumphed. The leaves of the grapevine shook and the possum vanished.
That'll show you,
exulted Iori. He was drenched with sweat, but he felt relieved and refreshed. He only hoped he would be able to repeat the performance the next time he confronted Musashi. Having lowered a reed blind on the window and snuffed out the lamp, he went to bed. A bluish-white light reflected from the grass outside. He dozed off, but inside his head he seemed to see a tiny spot, shining like a jewel. In time, the spot grew into the vague outline of the possum's face. Tossing and moaning, he was suddenly overwhelmed by the conviction that there were eyes at the foot of his pallet. He roused himself with difficulty.
Bastard!
He cried, reaching for his sword. He took a murderous swing but ended up doing a somersault. The shadow of the possum was a moving spot on the blind. He slashed at it wildly, then ran outside and hacked fiercely at the grapevine. His eyes rose skyward in search of the eyes. There came into focus, slowly, two large, bluish stars. Four Sages with a Single Light.
Here we are,
Shinzo said as they reached the foot of Akagi Hill. From the flute music, which sounded like the accompaniment to a sacred shrine dance, and the bonfire visible through the woods, Musashi thought a night festival must be in progress. The trip to Shigome had taken 2 hours. On one side was the spacious compound of Akagi Shrine. Across the sloping street stood the earthen wall of a large private residence and a gate of magnificent proportions. When they reached the gate, Musashi dismounted and handed the reins to Shinzo, thanking him as he did so. Shinzo led the horse inside and handed the reins to one of a group of samurai waiting near the entrance with paper lanterns in their hands. They all came forward, welcomed him back, and led the way through the trees to a clearing in front of the imposing entrance hall. Inside, servants holding lanterns were lined up on both sides of the hallway. The chief steward greeted them, saying, "Come in. His lordship is expecting you. I'll show you the way."
"Thank you," replied Musashi. He followed the steward up a stairway and into a waiting room. The design of the house was unusual. One stairway after another led to a series of apartments, which gave the impression of being stacked one above another all the way up Akagi Hill. As he seated himself, Musashi noted that the room was well up the slope. Beyond a drop at the edge of the garden, he could just make out the northern part of the castle moat and the woods framing the escarpment. He found himself thinking that the view from the room in the daytime must be breathtaking. Noiselessly, the door in an arched doorway slid open. A beautiful serving girl came gracefully in and placed a tray bearing cakes, tea, and tobacco in front of him. Then she slipped out as quietly as she had entered. It seemed as if her colorful kimono and obi had emerged from and melted into the wall itself. A faint fragrance lingered after her, and suddenly Musashi was reminded of the existence of women. The master of the house appeared shortly after that, attended by a young samurai. Dispensing with formalities, he said,
"Good of you to come."
In good soldierly fashion, he seated himself cross-legged on a cushion spread by the attendant and said,
"From what I hear, my son is much indebted to you. I hope you'll pardon my asking you to come here rather than visiting your house to express my thanks."
With his hands resting lightly on the fan in his lap, he inclined his prominent forehead ever so slightly.
"I'm honored to be invited to meet you," said Musashi.
It was not easy to estimate Hojo Ujikatsu's age. Three front teeth were missing, but his smooth, shiny skin testified to a determination never to grow old. The heavy black mustache, streaked with only a few white hairs, had been allowed to grow out on both sides to conceal any wrinkles resulting from the lack of teeth. Musashi's first impression was of a man who had many children and got along well with young people. Sensing that his host wouldn't object, Musashi went straight to the point.
"Your son tells me that you have a guest who knows me. Who might that be?"
"Not one, but two. You'll see them by and by."
"Two people?"
"Yes. They know each other very well, and both are good friends of mine. I happened to meet them at the castle today. They came back with me, and when Shinzo came in to greet them, we started chatting about you. One of them said he hadn't seen you for a long time, and would like to. The other, who knows you only by reputation, expressed a desire to be introduced."
Smiling broadly, Musashi said, "I think I know. One is Takuan Soho, isn't it?"
"That's right!" exclaimed
Lord Ujikatsu, slapping his knee in surprise.
"I haven't seen him since I came east several years ago."
Before Musashi had time to make a guess at who the other man was, his lordship said,
"Come with me,"
and went out into the corridor. They climbed a short stairway and walked down a long, dark corridor. Rain shutters were in place on one side. Suddenly, Musashi lost sight of Lord Ujikatsu. He stopped and listened. After a few moments, Ujikatsu called,
"I'm down here."
His voice seemed to come from a well-lit room that was situated across an open space from the corridor.
"I understand," Musashi called back. Instead of heading directly for the light, he stood where he was.
The space outside the corridor was openly inviting, but something told him danger lurked in that stretch of darkness.
"What are you waiting for, Musashi? We're over here."
"Coming," answered Musashi.
He was in no position to reply otherwise, but his sixth sense had warned him to be on the alert. Stealthily, He turned and walked back about 10 paces to a small door which led out onto the garden. Slipping on a pair of sandals, he made his way around the garden to the veranda of Lord Ujikatsu's parlor.
"Oh, you came that way, did you?"
said his lordship, looking around from the other end of the room. He sounded disappointed.
"Takuan!" called Musashi as he entered the room, a radiant smile on his face.
The priest, seated in front of the alcove, stood up to greet him. To meet again, and under the roof of Lord Hojo Ujikatsu, seemed almost too fortuitous. Musashi had trouble convincing himself that it was really happening.
"We'll have to bring each other up to date," said Takuan. "Shall I begin?"
He was clad in the plain robes he always wore. No finery, not so much as prayer beads. Yet he seemed mellower than before, more soft-spoken. Just as Musashi's rural upbringing had been leached out of him by strenuous attempts at self-discipline, Takuan, too, seemed to have had the sharper corners rounded off and to have become more deeply endowed with the wisdom of Zen. To be sure, he was no longer a youth. 11 years older than Musashi, he was now approaching 40.
"Let's see. Kyoto, wasn't it? Ah, I remember. It was shortly before I went back to Tajima. After my mother died, I spent a year in mourning. Then I traveled for a while, spent some time at the Nansoji in Izumi, then at the Daitokuji. Later, I saw a good deal of Lord Karasumaru, composed poetry with him, had tea ceremonies, fended off the cares of this world. Before I knew it, I'd spent 3 years in Kyoto. Recently, I became friendly with Lord Koide of Kishiwada Castle and came with him to have a look at Edo."
"Then you've been here only a short time?"
"Yes. Although I've met Hidetada twice at the Daitokuji and been summoned into Ieyasu's presence a number of times, this is my first trip to Edo. And what about you?"
"I've been here only since the beginning of this summer."
"It seems you've made quite a name for yourself in this part of the country."
Musashi didn't try to justify himself. He hung his head and said,
"I suppose you've heard about that."
Takuan stared at him for a few moments, seemingly comparing him with the Takezo of old.
"Why worry about that? It'd be strange if a man your age had too good a reputation. So long as you haven't done anything disloyal or ignoble or rebellious, what does it matter? I'm more interested in hearing about your training."
Musashi gave a brief account of his recent experiences and ended by saying, "I'm afraid I'm still immature, imprudent, far from being truly enlightened. The more I travel, the longer the road becomes. I have the feeling I'm climbing an endless mountain path."
"That's the way it has to be," said Takuan, clearly pleased with the youth's integrity and humility. "If a man not yet 30 claims to know the least bit about the way, it's an unmistakable sign his growth has stopped. Even I still shudder with embarrassment when anyone suggests that an uncouth priest like me could know the ultimate meaning of Zen. It's disconcerting, the way people are always asking me to tell them about the Buddhist law or explain the true teachings. People try to look up to a priest as a living Buddha. Be thankful that others don't overestimate you, that you don't have to pay attention to appearances."
While the two men happily renewed their friendship, servants arrived with food and drink. Presently, Takuan said,
"Forgive me, your lordship. I'm afraid we're forgetting something. Why don't you call your other guest in?"
Musashi was certain now that he knew who the fourth person was, but elected to remain silent. Hesitating slightly, Ujikatsu said, "Shall I call him?" Then to Musashi,
"I'll have to admit you saw through our little trick. As the one who planned it, I feel rather ashamed."
Takuan laughed.
"Good for you! I'm glad to see you're up to admitting defeat. But why not? It was only a game to amuse everybody anyway, wasn't it? Certainly nothing for the master of the Hojo style to lose face over. Well, no doubt I was defeated.
murmured Ujikatsu, reluctance still in his voice.
The truth is that, although I've heard what sort of man you are, I had no way of knowing just how well-trained and disciplined